From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. President-elect Barack Obama went before the nation today to formally announce his economic team. For people who follow government or high finance the way many folks follow sports, this is the starting lineup. Timothy Geithner has been nominated Secretary of the Treasury. Former Harvard University President Lauren Summers is Director of the National Economic Council. Christina Romer will chair the Council of Economic Advisors. Melody Barnes is Director of Domestic Policy. In a minute, we're going to talk to someone who's been directly affected by this economic crash. But first, Keith Reed is here to give us more information on today's announcement. He's a reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, and his personal blog is Keith Reed's Money Corner. Hi, Keith.
Hey, Farai. How you doing?
I am doing great. So the president-elect just unveiled the team that's helping to guide him through the pitfalls of our struggling economy.
Yeah, and I think it was an interesting lineup. There weren't too many surprises, but it did give him, I think, a little bit more stability and a little bit more credibility in that it showed the direction that he's thinking in terms of what he's going to do when he announces his in the next few weeks or in the next month or so, his plan for stimulus. One of the things that Barack Obama was criticized about is whether or not he's appearing to be a little bit too hands-off with the economy. You remember, if you go back a few weeks to his election, and he said, listen, there's only one president at a time. If you watched his press conference today, he talked about the need being immediate. He talked about his team needing to get to work right away. And so now he's at a point where he wants to appear to be very much on the case. One of the other things, and I'll try to make this point quickly, is that he's also done a good job of tapping some Washington insiders, some people who are graybeards, some people who have been around, who've worked in previous administrations, who have held these kinds of posts. And he's also tapped a couple of people who are progressives. People have sort of asked Obama, you know, progressives are sort of the wing of the Democratic Party that really swept you into popularity. What are you going to do to have some presence of progressives? And if you look at Melody Barnes, much of her writing, much of her work has been from a progressive left of center standpoint. There's probably a good primer would be to read what she wrote in the Washington Post January 22nd, 2007, when she said she wrote an essay called What a Progressive President Might Say, prefacing what she would like to have heard in George W. Bush's upcoming State of the Union address at that time, had he been a progressive president.
Well, I want to hear a little bit of the president himself. Here he is from today's speech.
We have a consensus, which is pretty rare, between conservative economists and liberal economists, that we need a big stimulus package that will jolt the economy back into shape, and that is focused on the 2.5 million jobs that I intend to create during the first part of my administration.
There you saw a response, actually, to one of the reporter's questions, which was, well, you know, how big is this thing? How big is it going to get? What form is this bailout going to take? What are we really talking about? I want to talk more specifically in a second about a couple of big moves regarding Citigroup and the auto industry. But there are already starting to be these questions about what the nation has gotten itself into and how soon the president-elect will give some shape to this big blob of capital that really is, you know, what's going on through the government.
Yeah, I mean, he's going to have to at some point be very blunt. And he also telegraphed this today during his speech that he understands that there. I think his direct wording was that he's going to have to go through the federal budget line by line, looking for places where there can be cuts. I actually blogged about it this morning on Keith Reed's Money Corner that this is at some point. He's going to have to say how much this is going to cost, and more to the point, where is that money going to come from? I mean, you're looking. We already don't know where half of the original $700 billion economic rescue plan went. We don't know where that money is. Detroit came to Washington last week hat in hand and went back empty-handed, but we'll likely come back again. Citigroup is about to get $20 billion. We've seen what happened with AIG. President Bush has already said today that during his lame duck term that we still might see more rescue packages for individual companies that take the shape or form of Citigroup. And what Barack Obama is proposing, very necessary to do stimulus, very necessary to create some investment from the public sector, from Washington, in creating new jobs. But just where in the world is the money going to come from? He's going to have to answer to that. He's going to have to answer for that in detail and pretty quickly.
Now, when you look at the government agreeing to take this $20 billion stake in Citigroup and then the relatively cold shoulder that came from the visit of automakers to Washington, D.C., why the difference?
You know, there was a lot of discussion of this on some of the Sunday morning talk shows. And one of the points that came up was, you know, there's just a difference in how people tend to view blue-collar workers, blue-collar companies, when they come hat in hand saying, listen, we need to be saved, and white-collar ones. And you can, you know, pontificate all you want about the reasons for that. But I think people have a different vision of Detroit, a different vision of manufacturing. It's an industry that has a reputation of very aggressive labor unions. There are many sectors, many people who are involved in economic policy who are against labor unions, who don't like that structure. There's been talk for the longest time of you know, Detroit, of the auto industry being a business that needs to get its act together. And I think a lot of that impression carries over when you look at some of the reality over the last few. And actually, you and I have talked on this show about some of the concessions that auto workers have made over the last 2 years or to 18 months. Many of these auto workers are already given up a lot. Many of those labor contracts have already been modified, even if those modifications haven't yet taken place. And so what the auto industry is saying is that, look, we're doing our best to get our act together, but we need to be able to survive into the point at which those new labor agreements are enforced, to the point at which those things that were cut can actually be put in place, and when we can get our cost structure in line. But if we don't survive into that point, you're going to talk about the loss of millions of middle class blue collar jobs across the heartland of the United States. And that's something that, you know, Washington is going to have to make up its mind on whether or not it can afford to allow that to happen.
All right, Keith, I want you to stay with us, but we've got someone else right here in our studios at NPR West, Los Angeles resident Julia Cox. She holds a college degree and has spent years working white-collar jobs, but she's been looking for work since January, and you came in to visit with us and talk about your journey. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
It would seem like, you know, everything would be life on a platter. You went to the University of Southern California, correct?
That's correct.
That's a pricey, very highly sought after school. And what did you do after that?
Initially, when I graduated, I had entered into the staffing industry for about 5 years. I was affected by 9/11 and was laid off not long after that. And then I had entered into the mortgage industry and had been in it ever since.
How many years was that?
Over five.
So when you think about what you did, it clearly you were providing a service for 5 years, or else you wouldn't have had a job that long. What specifically did you do?
I was a wholesale mortgage account executive, first for Greenpoint Mortgage, and lastly here with Aurora Loan Services, the wholesale mortgage arm of Lehman Brothers.
So I just want to, you know, for the sake of full disclosure, note that you are actually the niece of our host correspondent, Tony Cox, and we're very grateful that you could come on with us. There's no family that hasn't been hit by this, but when it comes to you and your individual life, what are the ripple effects of being out of work this long?
Well, you know, I've lost my home. I've had to move in with family as I look for work to try to get back on my feet. So it's had a major effect. Taking care of my children, oldest daughter in college, where initially I was paying cash for education because she couldn't afford to or didn't qualify for any federal or student aid, which now she does. But just not being able to take care of things that I've always been able to take care of, no longer able to do that.
I'm going to come back to you in a second because I really want to explore your story more. Keith, there's something that we hear a lot called discouraged workers, and that's people who've given up. We're sitting here with Julia, who hasn't given up, but it must take a lot to just keep going and going. Do you think that we're going to see a lot more discouraged workers in the coming months?
Yeah, you're definitely going to see a lot more discouraged workers. We've already seen many more discouraged workers. And one of the very difficult things that happens is when you see so many people hit the unemployment rolls, after a certain point, the economists stop counting them, because these are people who have been looking for a job for a significantly long amount of time. And then they say, you know what, I'm not going to look anymore. I need to figure out some other way. And they stop showing up in the unemployment statistics. So there's a percentage of that pie of people who are not in the workforce who stop being counted. And then you start to see a little bit of drop off in terms of the services that those people get or the resources that are available to people who are out of work, because you don't see the counting of everybody as they should.
Let's jump right back into this. Julia, you mentioned you lost your home. How did it unfold?
I wasn't able to make the payments anymore. And what I had done is I'd gone ahead and listed it to try to at least do a short sale. And fortunately, the kind of home that I had was a bargain for anyone that could afford to purchase it on a short sale. So I was fortunate enough to at least do the short sale, but it still takes about 4 months, and we're still in negotiations. But fortunately, it's not a complete foreclosure, but it is over a 50% loss.
So let's talk about some of these terms. And Keith, I would love you to help us. Keith, I'm going to name one of the terms she brought up. Tell me what it means. Short sale.
Short sale is essentially what happens when your house is what you call underwater. You own a house, but you can no longer sell that house for more than for at least the amount that you owe back to the bank. Or more. Okay, so you're not going to make a profit, and you're actually going to sell that house for less than you owe the bank. And essentially, what you have to do is you got to go to the bank and say, listen, you know, I'm in a position where even if I'm able to sell this, I'm not going to be able to repay you the money. And the bank has to actually agree to that, because of course they're holding a note and they want to be paid back. And that's why, as she alluded to earlier, that it takes a little while, because you have to a bank is going to put you through something of a process before they agree to you selling a house and them with their because what essentially what they're agreeing to is, okay, you're going to walk away from this deal and we're not going to get all of our money back.
Explain to us bankruptcy, and I know that actually didn't come up formally, but were you trying to avoid bankruptcy?
I am.
You're in bankruptcy.
I'm not in bankruptcy, but I'm trying to avoid it.
You're trying to avoid it. Mm-hmm.
But it's right on my back door.
Yeah, yeah. Why would someone, Keith, try so hard to avoid bankruptcy when the cards are stacked pretty hard against you?
Well, there are a lot of reasons to avoid bankruptcy, and really very very few to want to go into bankruptcy. I think people sort of view filing for bankruptcy, and when you say bankruptcy, what essentially you're talking about in most cases is a Chapter 11 filing, where you are protected to a certain extent from certain debtors coming after you. Until such time that you can restructure your finances and be able to pay them back. If you go through a chapter seven, that's when you're saying, you know, listen, I'm broke and I'm not going to be able to pay anybody back, and I need you to wipe. I need the court to legally wipe the slate clean. In either instance, it is a huge hit to your credit rating. It makes it very unlikely that for a period of at least 7 years or longer that you're going to be able to borrow money. And if you are able to borrow money, you won't be able to do so at favorable terms whatsoever. You're going to pay very high interest rates on any credit cards that you get, on any loans that you get. You're going to face significant scrutiny. We also know that everybody from insurance companies to employers are also looking through at people's financial and credit histories now. So filing a bankruptcy is not something that you go into lightly, because it can actually make the difference between whether or not you're actually able to get a job in the future. And if you're already in some financial trouble, I mean, that has obvious implications.
I want to go back to you, Julia. At this point, how do you go about job hunting? What are your means, whether it's newspapers, friends, Craigslist? What are you doing?
It's all of those. And right about now, it's who you know and not what you know. But Internet applying and applications and friends. I even call HR departments directly. And, of course, they don't take the calls because they're getting a large volume of calls from people looking for work. Employment agencies, everything that I could use, that's what I'm doing.
Why do you think you haven't had more luck?
For Southern California, I've been told that there are some employers that didn't want people in our industry or with our experience, the mortgage industry experience. Specifically, when you're trying to transition into another sales opportunity, it's almost as if we didn't count, or the kind of work we did wasn't real sales almost.
Do you feel taken advantage of in any way, only in the sense that the job that you had may not have given you the life experience that you hoped that would translate?
Yes, to some extent. I feel like the experience that I had and the work that I did, I mean, it was legitimate, good, hard work. I mean, it wasn't the kind of work where people think we were ripping people off, if you will. The work that was involved, it was honest work, and so it's sales. And so when you're transitioning, either you're a sales professional or you're not. Gadgets or widgets, you can sell it. And so I don't think any of us in our industry thought it would be a hard transition into another sales type of opportunity.
Would you consider moving?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. The United States is open to me. I'll go anywhere to work.
Mm-hmm. Keith, there are all sorts of articles that come out and say, you know, best place to retire. I know Black Enterprise just had one of those. But what do you consider the options of people who are willing to pack up and leave? Should folks consider different parts of the economy? And if so, where would they go?
I think you absolutely have to be willing to consider different parts of the economy, and you have to be willing to consider different geographies. Listen, this is a crisis, and it's been repeated so often that it's cliche that this is the worst economic crisis since, you know, name it, since the 70s, since the early 90s, since the Great Depression. But in large part, it's true, at least if you're looking at the what sectors are growing. There are simply very few sectors of the U.S. economy that are expected over the next 12 to 18 months to add jobs. There are some that may stay flat, but most industries, most sectors are contracting. And so if you found some, you know, some niche, some place where there's hope, you need to be willing to move if you're absolutely able. But right now, it's going to be tough. I mean, it's very difficult for me to think off the top of my head of any one sector where there's expected to be very much growth. And that's because so many different parts of the economy are tied together. I mean, if you think about where her career was, and one of the things that she said is I believe that she began in the staffing industry, correct?
That's correct.
If you Well, if you're in staffing today, I mean, there's not going to be a job there. Nobody's hiring. You're not going to, you know, a headhunter, somebody who's in an HR function. Many companies are these are the exact kinds of jobs that are being laid off. She went into a sales role, so you know, whether it's mortgages or it's cars or anything else, look at what's happening to salespeople. Companies aren't growing. They don't need more salespeople. I mean, you know,
Before we let you go, Keith, what is the one piece of good concrete advice that you can give Julia?
The one piece of good concrete advice that I would give Julia is that she's on the right track with her, you know, with her mindset, that she's willing to move and she's willing to look at other sectors. I mean, with today's economy, with the projections for job growth, which, you know, really is another way of saying that there aren't any projections for significant job growth. You've got to be flexible. You've got to be willing to look at other industries. You've got to be willing to look at other parts of the country. You've got to be ready to pack up and go and do something different and not be afraid of it. And I think she's on the right path there, so long as she's, you know, open to whatever opportunities might come might become available to her.
Well, I want to thank both of you for coming in, and Julia especially, for sharing your story.
Thank you so much.
We were speaking with Julia Cox, a college-educated mother of two who's been looking for work since January, and Keith Reed, a reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer. He also blogs at KeithReedsMoneyCorner.com.